Welcome. I'm Jeffrey Snover, distinguished engineer and lead architect of Windows Server. And it is my honor and privilege to talk to you today about Windows Server 2012. I can't tell you how enthusiastic we are about this release. You know, I'm reminded of a time a new Rolling Stones album came out. And one of the critics said it was an instant classic. It was a classic because you listened to it and it was comfortable. It was what you knew you were going to hear from the Rolling Stones. And yet it was new, it was novel, it was innovative, it was edgy. And because it was this combination of familiar and innovative, it was an instant classic. And I think that best sums up Windows 2000 and Server 2012. It's familiar. Those of you who know Windows Server are going to feel very comfortable with it. It is the Windows Server you know and love. And yet, it's new, it's novel, it's innovative, in some ways even edgy. And it allows you, prepares you, to build a modern data center and address the challenges that we all have as in IT. So let's talk about that. So as we planned Windows Server 2012, we took a number of things into account. First, we took a look at the industry trends. There was, of course, the cloud. Okay? A few years ago, the cloud was indeed cloudy. A little bit lack of clarity, unsure how to talk about it, etc. We've gotten very clear about how we think about the cloud, about our unique approach to the cloud. Also, an explosion of data. There is a ton of data out there, just keeps growing. And with that data, we've learned how to get insight out of that data, and from insight, get competitive advantage, right? Business advantage. And when IT can connect the dots between IT and business advantage, the checkbooks open up, right? People are willing to spend. So the ability to process and manipulate large amounts of data is very important. And then, of course, mobile. In mobile, we have lots and lots of devices. Each of us contain, you know, have a number of devices with them, often personal devices. And so the ability to deal with those multiple devices was very important. Next, we took a look at the technology innovation. Right, technology, of course, always advancing. In the area of CPUs and computing, once high-end, esoteric technologies like multi-core, NUMA technologies, technologies that required, you know, the top programmers, some of the most sophisticated programmers, are now commonplace. And so it's the role of the operating system to take these once esoteric technologies and make them available to everyone in a very simple way. In the area of networking, after a long period of 1 gigabit, now 10 gigabit is coming down to a price where we're seeing it commonplace. And shortly after 10 gigabit comes 40 gigabit, and after that 100 gigabit. InfiniBand, RDMA, hardware acceleration, lots of innovation happening in network. And of course in storage, SSDs, the prices are plummeting, we have new storage architectures and technologies. We took those all into account. We then drew upon our experience, right? We got very good at listening to our customers, listening to you. Today, for every 100 servers that get built, 75 of them end up with Windows Server on them. So Windows has quite a large footprint in the industry. And we went out and talked to people just like you and said, hey, where's it working for you? Where's it not working for you? Where can we do better? And we paid attention. We spent over $10 million doing this kind of customer research. And then the cloud. Think of this. Think, what are the, say, top 5 or top 10 software manufacturers in the world? People who produce software products that you can purchase and run. Okay? Now, then think, what are the top 10, 5 or 10 companies that have cloud properties? And there's only one company where both names are on both lists, where the name is on both lists, and that's Microsoft. We have some of the largest cloud properties in the world with Hotmail, Bing, Azure. And so we went and talked to them and said, hey, you're using Microsoft, you're using Windows, where is you having troubles, where can we do a better job? And so we drew upon this experience to do our planning to produce and enable a modern data center. And we did this planning together with Windows System Center. Sorry, so it's Windows Server 2012 and System Center 2012. And we designed these products together to enable the modern data center. So let's talk about this transformation, right? So in the past, we had servers and applications, and honestly, these two were chained together. And this produced, it was hard to separate, what is the server from what is the application. And this produced a rather fragile and rigid environment. Virtualization cut those chains and offered a certain degree of agility. It turns out it wasn't as much agility as we thought it was going to give us, but it was quite a bit. And here I'd like to stop and do a hats off, give a hats off to our competitors in this area. They've done a great job. But before I get into that, let me talk about a previous competitor. How many of you are currently running Novell? Okay, didn't see any hands, and these guys over here are saying, what's a Novell? Okay, well, at one point in time, there was a great company called Novell, a dominant vendor in an area. And Microsoft looked at this and said, wow, they're doing some great stuff, but wait, what the heck? They fired up our competitive juices, right? Got fire in the belly, and asked ourselves, why are we doing this? Isn't there a better way? Is there a new approach? And we responded and produced the Windows Server that you have today. And today, Novell, a once great dominant player, is really kind of a footnote in the history of computing. But they had great engineers and great products at the time. And so too, at this moment, I'd like to acknowledge some of the great work of the competitors that we've had. They've got some great engineers and they've done some great work. And they too fired up the Microsoft competitive spirit, where we took our engineers and we asked, why does it have to be this way? Why can't we do it this way? Are we solving the right problems? And we brought our innovation to bear in Windows 2012. So I think you're going to enjoy that. So again, hats off to the competitors. They did a good job. So what we did was, having broken the tie between the application and the server, we then say, hey, let's now pool those servers. Let's pool and separate the storage. Let's get a focus in on the networking and treat those all together. And really, this combination of computing, storage, and networking forms the cloud. And so our model is that now you run applications on the cloud to get great advantage. And as soon as you do that, you can run multiple applications on the cloud. And that gives you lots of benefits. Like, when one application isn't using a lot of the resources, it can free them up for the other applications. And then when it needs them, you can give them to them. Okay, so you get a degree of agility with that. And ultimately, now you can transform your application into services running on clouds. Now, this is where things change dramatically. Because once you have services running on the cloud, then you get to decide what type of cloud you want to run it on. Do I want to run it on an on-premises cloud? I want to stand up my own cloud and run my service on it. Or would I like to have Microsoft host that and run my service on their cloud? Or do I have a trusted hoster that I've got a business relationship with, they're an advisor, and I'd like to run my application on their cloud? Or would I like to take my service and run part of it here and part of it there? And in order to enable this flexibility and simplicity, we've had to deliver a set of commons, right? Common virtualization, common management, common identity, common deployment models and development tools. And so this is the modern data center, the attributes of a modern data center: shared resources, pooled, scalable and elastic, automated and self-service, right? Self-service is actually one of the acid tests of the cloud. In order to have self-service, you have to have a sufficient level of automation to support that. So if you don't have self-service, you have the right amount of automation. And then, of course, something that's always up and always on. And the benefits of this approach are, one, agility, right? Gives you lots of ability. The ability to, when your business partner comes to you and says, I need to do X, instead of being the traditional IT reputation of being the guardians of no, we now transform and we have the agility and the bandwidth to start saying yes, yes, yes. And we become great business partners. It provides great economics. Boy, the numbers that you will see with Windows Server 2012, some of the things that in the past required just extraordinarily, you know, large budgets, you can now do on a shoestring, okay? And focus. Focus means that you've got people who understand something and they focus in on it and let other people focus on other things. Self-service, for instance. Self-service allows you to focus in on providing the infrastructure, and then someone else can focus in on consuming the infrastructure when and how they want it. And the separation of concerns gives great benefits. So let's talk about this transforming the data center. Built upon Windows Server 2012 and System Center 2012. And the bulk of this conversation is going to be demos. And so we're going to show you these things in four parts, and we've got a special announcement in the middle. So that's going to be some good stuff. So first, we're going to talk about the ability to build and scale your infrastructure. We're then going to make a transition into applications, right? OSs are great, but it's really about the applications. So what are we doing to be able to deploy, to develop and deploy those applications, the ability to manage and maintain high availability, and then the ability to securely deliver these services to all the devices in your environment. So let's talk about building and scaling your infrastructure. There's lots of things we have in this area. Some of the key highlights here are virtualization, scalability, and management. Scalability, my heavens, some of the things we've done in this release. On the virtualization front, you can have up to 320 logical processors for your virtualization host. The VMs themselves, our competitors last year made a big deal about their monster VMs. Good heavens, a monster VM. It had 32 logical processors. We're giving you 64 logical processors and a terabyte of RAM. And guess what? That terabyte of RAM costs the same as a small amount of RAM, unlike our competitors, where a terabyte of RAM will make you broke. Okay, so we got a great business model along with this as well. In terms of virtualization, again, we looked at virtualization. We thought it was going to give us this great agility, and it turned out that that was really not the case. It gave us a lot, but not really the agility. What you needed was virtualization of the networking as well as virtualization of the server to get the agility we thought we were going to get. Okay, and then management. Management is key to this, and we made a huge investment in standards-based management. Okay, I want to highlight that. Standards-based management. In fact, I'll be doing an entire session on this about our embrace of standards. Okay, so with that, let's bring out Michael Leeworthy, who's going to talk to us about IP portability with hypervisor. Michael.
Awesome. How you doing, mate?
Doing great.
Hello. So I want to talk about what I think is one of the best features of Hyper-V that I've seen from the team. Now, I've worked at Windows Server for about 10 years and Hyper-V for the last three, and network virtualization is just one of those technologies that's just cool. Now, let me give you an example here. With server virtualization, we virtualize the hardware, you know, the GPUs, the CPUs, and memory. And then Windows Server 2012, we've got new types of virtualization. We now have storage virtualization with storage spaces that allow you to take the just a bunch of disks, the commodity hardware, and really create flexible and resilient storage solutions. And then we have this new technology called network virtualization. And as you said, this is, you know, this is brand new for us, brand new for the industry, and really provides a lot of great ease in the way you're going to roll out network infrastructure both on-premise and in the cloud. So I want to talk a little bit about some of the scenarios of network virtualization and what it can mean for you. Now, we have lots and lots of sessions on it, but I want to focus on two of them, multi-tenant isolation and another one we call IP portability. Now, with network virtualization out of the box, you get multi-tenant isolation.
And we still have that great screensaver.
So the great thing here is whether I'm a hoster or whether I'm an organization, I can ensure that my VMs are separated from each other without using the complexity of VLANs. I can ensure they're isolated from each other as well, no matter whether they're divisions or whether they're companies that I'm hosting. Now, around IP portability, this gives me the ability to move a virtual machine from one site to another, from one subnet to another, from one geography to another, and from a data center into the cloud without changing my IP address. Because the challenge before is, if I want to move across a subnet, I have to reconfigure my IP addresses, my address spaces. If I have to move into the cloud, usually the IP provider, the service provider, is going to say, here is the IP address ranges you need to use. And I have to do complex configurations.
Indeed. You know, I went to a competitor's webinar about disaster recovery and the ability that says, in a disaster, you can move your VMs from here to a service provider or to an alternate data center. And, you know, what the large print giveth, the small print taketh away. In order to actually achieve that, you had to buy this special product, and the hoops that you had to go through to adjust the IP addresses, they have this entire workflow product around it. It was quite hideous, and expensive, by the way.
Absolutely.
And that's not the case here.
We all understand the complexity of VLANs, and especially if VLANs get out of control. So what I want to show you is how you can do IP portability and network virtualization, how you can move VMs across subnets without the complexity of VLANs in your organization.
Let's go.
So what you're seeing here is Virtual Machine Manager with System Center 2012. This is our CTP2 version, or the SP1 version, that we currently have in our technology preview. And I have two sites set up here. I have a New York site, and I have a Seattle site. And you can see here that my New York site has a 172.17 subnet, and my Seattle site has a 172.16 subnet. So these are completely two different subnets, separated in this case by geography. If I go look at my virtual machine services associated with those, you can see that I have two servers, one server in each of those sites. And the big thing here is while I might be running CoHost Server 1 in one site and CoHost Server 3 in the other one, you also see that I'm running other virtual machines in a fully isolated environment. So even though I'm running a customer virtual machine, I can happily run infrastructure servers, other customer servers, and other division servers, ensuring full isolation from all those virtual machines as I require. You can see here that I have my, if I go in my New York site, I have my CoHost Server 1 here, and if I go into my Seattle site, I have my CoHost Server 3 here. So you can see that we have completely two separate networks, completely two separate hosts, connected by a subnet. Let's kind of have a look at those, what those virtual machines actually look like. So here I'm going to just shoot up the virtual machines. You can see my CoHost Server 1 has an IP address of 10.2.1.4. So the first thing you're seeing here is that even though they're in that 172 subnet, these have a completely different IP address range. And in case if I look at my CoHost Server 3, I can also do an IP config here and have it, and you can see it's in the same IP address range as the CoHost Server 1. So even though these are sitting in two different subnets, my virtual network fabric is providing that singular subnet. And these guys can ping each other and basically treat each other like they're exactly in the same subnet, on the same switch, almost in the same rack. So it's one of the great advantages of network virtualization. I don't have to worry about all this VLAN complexity, all this subnet complexity. I'm doing it at the network virtualization layer. Now, the good thing here is I've also created a couple of PowerShell scripts, which is, I know, near and dear to Jeffrey's heart.
It is.
And the great thing about here is it will show you the underlying structure of what network virtualization provides. So on top, I have my host server 3, which is sitting in New York. Sorry, host server 2, which is sitting in New York. And my host server 3 on the bottom, which is sitting in Seattle. You can see there is that CoHost Server 1 and CoHost Server 3 servers. And you can see those IP addresses that we saw in the ping.
So here you're talking to the virtualization hosts, one in each city, and you're saying, tell me about your clients. And
yes.
So it's telling you what the client thinks its IP address is versus what its actual IP address is.
And absolutely, and that's where the magic is. Underneath here, you have a provider address. So this is the physical IP address for those virtual machines in this environment, which is controlled by Virtual Machine Manager and Windows Server 2012. Now, even though I showed it in Virtual Machine Manager, you could do this whole thing in PowerShell as well. So you could utilize Windows Server 2012 and PowerShell, which is great for automation and repeatability. But the great thing here is that provider address is hidden from my virtual machine layer. My virtual machines effectively are in that 10.2 subnet. Now, the great thing about that is we also control the address space of that provider address. So the Virtual Machine Manager and Windows Server 2012, our new extensions to DNS, will always know where those virtual machines are, no matter where they are in my organization, where they are on those host servers, and understand exactly what their provider address is so they can communicate to those. So let me show you a great example of that. Let's move a virtual machine from one subnet to another. So I'm going to go back to my Virtual Machine Manager here. I'm going to go to my CoHost Server 3, which is sitting in my Seattle site, and I'm going to migrate this virtual machine across the subnet. So we're just going to go and do a little bit of research on the current hosts that are available. I'm just going to choose all hosts, so it shows me all the hosts that may be available for this live migration. And you can see here is that WS12 host 2, which is sitting in my New York office. I'm doing a live migration, and I have multiple different ways to migrate, live migration, shared nothing live migration, SMB live migration. Give me all these great choices. One of the big powerful things here is everything I do associated with virtual machines in System Center, I can actually export a script.
Is that beautiful or what?
It's a beautiful thing. So this gives me full ability to automate this, to orchestrate it, to utilize it in runbooks, to repeat it. If I'm a partner, I can take this script and I can use this in my customer organizations. It's a very, very powerful tool.
So you could use this with some of the System Center products to monitor certain conditions, and when they occur, script the live migration of the VM. And it'll show you how to do it.
So let's kick that move off, and because this is a fairly small virtual machine, we should actually...
Now let's make sure I get this right. So you're taking a VM from Seattle, and you're moving it to New York.
Exactly. While we're speaking.
And it stays on the same subnet.
Stays on the same subnet.
Because it's virtual.
But the great thing here is why I'm moving that, because it's live migration, even though I'm maybe utilizing shared nothing live migration, my users can still access it. They don't know it's moving across subnets. They don't even know it's moving across servers. They can still access it like it's sitting on the same server. Now, if we go back here, you can see that server is happily sitting in my New York site now. But the magic is if we minimize this and go back to my PowerShell scripts, if we run the one down the bottom, you can see it returns nothing. If we run the one up the top, you can see that 10.2.19 address has come in, and you can see its subnet has changed to .17. However, it still has the 10.2.1.9 address. This shows you one of the powerful features of network virtualization, IP portability, keeping your address space no matter where you're creating that virtual machine, whether doing it locally, geographically, or into the cloud, provides you the ultimate flexibility. Thank you.
Awesome, Michael. I love that stuff. I tell you, you just gotta love that stuff. It is awesome. Okay, so now we got lots and lots of detailed sessions on this stuff. We've produced a URL here for you. After each one of the done, you might want to get a pen out and write this out. This URL will point to all the sessions broken down by the various areas for drilling topics. And if you don't get it right now, don't worry about it. After each demo, we'll show the same slide, and I'll take a minute so you can write it down. So let's talk about deploying and managing your applications, okay? So here, you know, OSs are great, but really OSs are about running applications, right? And so with Windows Server 2012, we wanted to be the best OS to write and run applications, traditional applications or cloud scale applications. And so we've got IIS 8.0 and ASP.NET 4.5. Fantastic new technologies, again, focusing in on scalability. It turns out that these NUMA technologies really require re-architecture at each layer of the stack in order to get their full potential. If you don't do that work, you can, in fact, have negative performance. And so now with IIS 8, we have this nice linear performance. If you look at some of the details that we'll talk about in the tracks, the scalability of our NUMA support is just phenomenal. I mean, just it will knock your socks off as an engineer. So too with virtualization and hosting. If you're a hoster, we have a lot of features for you. High-density hosting, the ability to sandbox and CPU limit things, the ability to have bulk SSL mappings, and of course as developers. We have world-class developer tools and new features like WebSocket protocol support and PubSub messaging. Just fantastic stuff. And so to drill into that, let me bring out Prabhu, who's going to talk to you about deploying multi-tenant websites.
Right. Hey, Jeffrey.
How you doing?
Good. Nice to meet you. Thank you. All right, let's have some fun with IaaS today, shall we? Over the course of the next 10 minutes, I'm going to walk you through three new features that we've added in IaaS. So let's just jump right into the demo. First up, certificate management. Over the last 2 to 3 years, we spoke to a lot of IT pros. And one thing that constantly came up is managing certificates, right? The only time when IT pros want to worry about certificates is when they expire. And they just want to update the certificates and get on with their business. Let's see what we've done with IaaS. So let me just go ahead and open my application.
Has anybody ever seen that before?
So looks like I have some issue with my certificates. Now let's see what's going on. I'm going into my IaaS console now. And you see a new icon here called Centralized Certificates. What this is a centralized location for managing all your certificates across all the applications, across all the servers in your data center. One single location to manage all certificates. Let me just go ahead and open it. And it lists the certificates that are there and the most important information that you care about, right? So it gives you the name of the certificate, who issued it, and most importantly, when the certificate expires. As you can see, my certificate expired a month or so back. And I need to fix this. Let's see how we do it. So in here, I have an option to open wherever the certificates are stored. And if you notice, it's now an SMB file share. So you can actually create a file share and store all your certificates in that file share and point IaaS to that file share, and it's going to load it up automatically.
So all the IaaS servers in a farm can point to the same pool.
And all that you need to do is just update the certificate once, and all the servers pick it up. And let me show you how easy it is to update the certificates, right? So this is what my application is using currently. Let me move to the location where I have my updated certificates. I just copy and then paste it here.
So you did a drag and drop? That's how you do it?
Yeah, that is all that you have to do.
That's the management interface?
That's it.
Okay.
So let's go back into the certificate repository. I do a refresh, and you see that the expiration date is updated now. Now, the next time the application is loaded, the policies are going to be pushed up to the application, and the application should work. So let me just go ahead, close the application, and then open it up again.
I've worked with certs before, and it's never been that easy.
Right. So it's a private root certificate, so it usually takes a couple of seconds for it to load.
Sure.
So over the next, there you go, the application is up and running now, and the certificate issue is gone.
Wow. That's awesome.
Yeah. Thanks. So let's just step this up a little bit more now, right?
Yeah, give it up. That was pretty cool.
So for the next part of the demo, this is the part that I enjoy the most, right? Because I get to be the dirty guy now. Oh, I'm going to do bad things to the web server. So if I move on to this machine, I have my application that I just showed you open. And I have another application, which is uglier than the one that I just showed you, which also runs on the same server. And I have the fancy, dirty little application that I wrote, which is going to do bad things to my web server, right? So as you can see, I could increase the CPU utilization. I could simulate a denial of service attack, which is what I'm going to do now. So I'm wearing a hat of a hacker now, and I'm going to simulate a denial of service attack. And what this is going to do is generate a whole bunch of zombies that's going to start hammering my server, right? And my server is now busy servicing these requests. And let's see what's happening to the server. So I go back into my web server. There you go. So my server is working pretty hard, running at around 73% and fluctuating all around, trying to service those requests. So the problem with this is, as the server attempts to handle these zombies that come in, the resources of the server are not available to other applications that are running, right? Which is not a good thing.
So it seems to me that would be a problem for hosters.
Exactly.
Because then their customer is going to be calling up saying, hello.
Exactly. So when I have multiple applications that are running on the same server, my server is now servicing a specific application, and the other applications aren't running as expected. So let's see how we can fix it, right? There are two problems currently. First, ensure that your server and its resources are available to all the applications that are running. Mm-hmm. And second, malicious users like me need to be kicked out as soon as possible, right? So my application pool now lists all the applications, right? So go into advanced settings, and I now have the ability to throttle my application, right? So what's happening here is I've set a maximum of 50% to this specific application. So no matter what happens, it's not going to get more than 50% off CPU at any point of time.
Dude, right? We screwed up the demo.
Yeah, I know.
So you notice we forgot to reset the demo, and so when you saw the CPU, it wasn't pegged, and that's because we had the throttling already engaged. If we didn't have that, you would have seen the CPU absolutely pegged at 100% with all of the zombies attacking it. But we already showed you the reveal. It was down low because we had that.
Which is what I'm going to show you now. So it's running at around 100% now, right?
Yeah.
So let's just go back and fix it. So I go back, throttle the CPU to about a 50%.
And we're not actually entering the percentage, right? It's like milliseconds we're adding here. So it's a time quantum.
And then throttle it, and then click OK. So what you're going to see now is, over the next few seconds, this percentage is going to drop down to 50. So that shows that this specific IIS process is slowly scaling down to 50%. There you go. It's close to 33% now. Wow. Now, let's just go ahead and fix the problem, right?
So how do you fix the problem?
So I'm going to block this bad guy out now.
What, by its IP address, or?
I don't even have to mention the IP address. That's the greatest thing, right? So what I'm going to do now is, as soon as this opens up, I have the ability to dynamically block requests depending on the criteria that I set. So I go in here, and then I say any request that comes in within a 3 millisecond time period, as in if I get more than one request within 3 milliseconds, block it. My application is not going to behave that way. So I go ahead and set this.
And so basically, we've looked at patterns of DOS attacks, and we've hardwired or provided templates for DOS denials.
Exactly. So I had a whole bunch of zombies that were generated, right? Over the next few seconds, this is going to drop down to 25% and then down to 5 or 3%. There you go. It's about 13% now.
Seven.
Yeah. So what I've effectively shown you over the last 10 minutes is, number one, certificate management. Whether you have a single server with just one application running, or whether you have hundreds of servers with hundreds of applications running, certificate management takes a minute, couple of minutes. All that you need to do is just copy over the new certificates, and it's business as usual after that. And the second thing is managing performance of your applications, right? You now have the ability to throttle your CPU and say that, you know, application one, you get 25% because this is the SLA that we've guaranteed. And application two, you get the remaining 75%. And number three, it gives you the power to either reactively or proactively block malicious users from attacking your system. That's pretty much it. So all that I've done now is just scratch the surface, right? I'm hoping that over the next week, you get an opportunity to understand all work that we've done with Windows Server 2012 and specifically IIS. Thank you, and hopefully have a good tech head. Thank you.
Great, thanks so much. Boy, is that some fun stuff. All right. So again, this is the URL that you can go to and find all the drill-in sessions around IIS 8 and ASP.NET 4.5. Thanks. So next, we want to talk about the ability to manage and maintain availability. Manage your systems and maintain availability. In this release, we have a quantum leap in the manageability of Windows Server. It was actually pretty great to start with, but in terms of automation, you know, when we first shipped PowerShell, we shipped with 130 commandlets. Okay, pretty modest. In the last version, we shipped with 230 commandlets, And in this version, in Windows Server 2012, we're shipping with over 2,300 commandlets. So a massive increase in your ability to automate the server. Now, in addition to that, we made a major investment in standards-based management. Now, we've always done standards-based management with WMI. But honestly, it was WMI over DCOM, not exactly a standards protocol. So now we've fully embraced WSMAN, the standard management, and it is the primary management protocol. Now, DCOM still provided for backward compatibility, but now standards is a full first-class citizen. Oh, and of course, Server Manager. This is a transformational release for Server. In the past, we really saw ourselves as being an OS for a server. But with Windows Server 2012, we have a new identity. We think of ourselves as having a mission of being a cloud OS. And a cloud OS means that we have to be able to run and manage lots of servers and all the devices that connect those servers together, whether they're network devices, PDUs, storage, etc. We take responsibility for all of that. Now, that is a very long-term commitment, and it will take us multiple releases to bring it to full fruition. But in Windows Server 2012, we make an awesome first step. Server Manager transforms from being a single machine management tool to being a multi-machine management tool. And wait till you see it. It is just gorgeous. Also, around continuous availability, we focused in and talked to customers and did analysis of site downs, what caused downtime. And then we put together a comprehensive plan. And let me underscore this notion of comprehensiveness. Okay, unlike all of our competitors, we have the ability to do the deep engineering at whatever level is required to do the job right. And so in many of the things you'll see during this week, whether it's storage or networking or whatever, you're going to hear this nice high-level feature. But the reality is that we had to go down into every level of the system to do deep technical work to make those features happen. And that's something our competitors can't do. So in the area of continuous availability around a single node, we transformed how we manage data to a disk, flushing it, and also the ability to do online repairs of the file system. We, in the past, check disk could take minutes, sometimes hours, sometimes many hours to complete. And now, because of our new architecture, it takes seconds. Okay? In the area of multi-node availability, we now have improvements in clustering, where you can have up to 64 machines in a cluster. We have clustered continuous file server. Now here, this is a distinction between continuous availability and high availability. Continuous availability is a much higher bar. High availability says that if a client is attached to a server and that server goes down, then you can fail over to another server, the application sees that failure, but if they try it again, it'll happen. Continuous availability says that if that server goes down, the alternate will detect it and come online to take over its service in time so that the client sees no interruption in service, right? So applications don't need to be rewritten. In order to accomplish that, let me tell you, is an engineering tour de force. Every single layer of our storage stack had to be addressed. Okay, so we did great work there. And then in the area of multi-site continuous availability, we can now back up to the cloud, and we've got Hyper-V replica. Hyper-V replica is the ability to take hypervisor VMs and say, I'd like to replicate them to an alternate site. And you've got lots of different options there. So if something happens, you can then bring up that VM on that alternate site. And again, unlike some others in the industry, this is built in. This is not a multiple, a very expensive per VM add-on. It's built into the operating system. So with that, let me bring out Rick Claus to talk to you about multi-server management and cluster-aware updating. I didn't mention cluster-aware updating. Again, multi-machine environment, the ability to update the cluster. And, well, Rick will tell us all about it. Hi, Rick.
Hey, Jeffrey. How you doing?
I'm doing great.
Good. Good.
Show us some good stuff.
Yes. I see. Wait for my monitor to warm up over here. I'm going to actually terminal serve back into a demonstration machine back in Corp that is set up to be able to go and do some clusterware updating. Now, high availability, as you mentioned, and updating of servers generally tend to get into a little bit of a conflict, especially when it happens to be something like, oh, I don't know, patch Tuesday, and you have to now patch your hosts as well as patching your guests. We've made that a little bit easier, just built into the tools, with using something that's called clusterware updating with the new Server 2012. So this can work for any workload. It can be SQL, can be Hyper-V, can be high availability file servers, can be anything. But now it simply is a very simple interface to be able to go off and to kick off this process for doing some clusterware updating. Let me show you this for a sec here. I've got a two-node cluster. They're doing a basic file share. It could be SQL, could be Hyper-V. And I bring up this little option here that says clusterware updating. The great thing about this is you can schedule this. You can make it so that it happens on the second Wednesday of the month. You can make it so it happens on the third Wednesday of the month, so it's a little bit after the patching process if you wanted to. You're in control of this with a bunch of parameters. I'm just going to go through here and show you the settings. So I'm going to enable self-updating mode, and you can set your schedule to be able to happen on a regular basis. The default for this guy is going to be the third Tuesday of every month. And then it's going to go through and give me all my runtime options that I can go off and do different things with, which is really cool here. Take a look at this. I can go in and basically say, go in and say, after a certain amount of time that it runs, cancel it after it's warned after so many error messages, roll it back. You get all this different granularity of different parameters that allow you to choose how you control the automated process. You don't just want to kick it and go.
Fine level of control.
Fine level of control. Now, here, I'm actually using one of two different plugins that we currently have for this. One plugin is going to be using just downloaded hotfixes and GRE updates from Microsoft PFEs or Microsoft support that you would get from download sites. Or it could also be the public Windows Update plugin as well. By RTM, we're going to have support for your own internal WSUS servers as well. So at this point, I'm just going to be using a hotfix plugin.
Now, can third parties use that too?
We are supporting whatever the public solution happens to be. So there's also BIOS updates, firmware updates, and driver updates that can take place if you want to. And you also can exclude all those if you wanted to as well.
So let's be clear. Now, the third parties can plug in and do BIOS updates in a cluster-aware way.
Yep. And again, if you're not ready for that level of comfort, you can always back out of that process. I just want to show you that I'm looking at a file share. I've already copied down about six hotfixes for this particular demo to be able to go off and to work. And then it gives me a confirmation. Because it's already configured, I'm going to cancel this, and I'm actually going to show you what it looks like when I'm going to do it. Because you can obviously manually override. In case there's an out-of-band hotfix you want to go and apply, you can go off and manually override this guy. Very simple confirmation wizard to basically say, are you sure you want to go ahead? Go ahead and do that update. And this kicks this off in the background. I'm going to move this out of the way so you can actually see the different nodes going through and doing this.
So when you're updating systems, that's typically going to then have a service interruption, right?
Yeah. So as you can actually see here, if I click back on my nodes and then back on my other screen there, you'll actually see the nodes going into various different states, going into waiting. It transfers the workload over to the other working node, does the patches, updates, meet your criteria. Then when it's done, it says I'm good again. It then migrates those workloads back again and then does the second node and does it and then gives you reports if there's any problems along the way.
So you update the cluster with all the latest patches without interrupting the service. Is that awesome or what?
Yeah, so that's six hot fixes in a go. Now, you also talked about multi-server management. So I'm going to switch over here to my other guy, which is, because I'm going to let that run in the background, a little bit about how I end up using and working with my Server 2012 on a regular basis. So I've actually logged in. I have a full GUI on this one. It's not my preferred way of working, but just to be able to show you what Server Manager looks like,
sure.
I'm using a full GUI. Nice interface at the very front to be able to tell you that at a glance I can go off and do some basic stuff.
Did you say nice? That thing is glorious.
Oh, it gets even better. So let me show you this. Let me show you this. So I can hide this out of the way because it's taking up a little bit of my space. I love green, as you can see from my hat. I want to see green on my boards as well.
Indeed.
I get all the basic information I want to see about my system, my IP address, my names, that sort of stuff. And then if I take a look at my individual server, you can see down below that we've optimized this to have a dynamic filter of 69 events. Let's see if I have any criticals. No criticals there. If I have any warnings, I got a couple of warnings I can look at. Notice that it's dynamically filtering that out for me for things that I want. I can save those if I wanted to. I can do the same thing for different services and how services are running. For instance, all the Hyper-V services does a nice little dynamic filter. And then also, if I had best practices running, there are currently none for this particular server. It's all good. And I love this part down here. Thresholds and warnings over time for trend analysis to say, hey, you're hitting 80% CPU utilization. You've had this much memory utilization. It can warn you and give you that red or green kind of interface at the at-a-glance. But this is kind of boring because it's only one server. So let's actually go back to real server management and look at multiple servers. I'm going to go up here and I'm going to say create a group. I'm going to call this group infrastructure.
You spell like I do, dude.
Yeah, I don't know how you do that when you're doing PowerShell scripts, let me tell you.
IntelliSense, that's how you do it.
I'm showing IntelliSense next. I've got Active Directory. I'm going to add in Server 1, Server 7, maybe Server 4. And these are my main infrastructure guys I want to take a look at. It goes out, contacts them with Windows Remote Management. It's already been enabled, and I can now get a status update on what each one of those are. You remember those individual 69 events? Well, now when I select all of these guys, I can see 276 events. And I had any criticals out there? Oh, I actually did have a couple of criticals that came up with some power outages that happened yesterday that I can go and take a look at. Even better, if I go and take a look at my dashboard perspective, that's a red dashboard. You don't like that look. Now, notice how it's also gone in and compartmentalized each of my different servers based on their types of roles that they have installed. So I got a quick at-a-glance view that I've got some issues with DNS, I've got some issues with file and services. If I go and take a look at my performance, I can actually go in and say, oh, okay, that was actually some performance testing I was running to try to max out my CPU count last night to get some nice red on my systems. I can go off and hide those guys, and then that'll actually clear up that one area. So I can come in the morning, see what's red, see what's green, address those issues and move on if I wanted to and that sort of stuff. But let's actually take this to the next level and not just look at it from a server console. Let's actually look at this in the correct way of looking at it, in my opinion, which is running this on Windows 8 client. Looks exactly the same. I've got the same type of alerts that happen to be there. Now, my refresh obviously hasn't occurred here yet, so that's why I still have some red. Besides being able to fix those performance things, I can actually go through and, I've got a bunch of different services that are actually stopped.
Wait, so let's make sure. So this looks exactly the same as before, but the difference is that this is now running on the client.
Entirely on Windows 8 client, managing my systems. Perfect. All from my desk as opposed to having to be inside the server room or TSing in the box. So I can remotely start all those five services and then resolve all those individual issues just on that one thing, and then that also goes to make my thing a little bit less red there as well.
Perfect.
Fantastic stuff, nice and easy. Some neat stuff I also like about the left-hand side of my dashboard is I can also go through and have it look specifically at some issues with WSUS as an example, or some things that are specific to IIS. It does the filtering for me, all great. Now, one other thing I happen to like as well is the ability that I can go off and like choose an individual server, right mouse click, and then I have context sensitive menus of going in and firing off those different management tools. Again, all from one spot. There's my IIS server, my common AD tools that I want to go off and hit my Active Directory management, all from one individual place, all very, very simple. But I had a request backstage that I want to go off and actually install a web server on server 02.
Damn.
So I can actually right click on server 02, say add roles and features from my client to a server in the back end, go through the wizard interface for very quickly adding a web service to this guy. So I'm going to say application server and IIS. I'm just going to go in and say add in all the defaults just so I can get to the end, because it's just a basic web server I'm trying to set up. And you'll like this. This will actually generate an XML file that I can then use from a PowerShell command to be able to apply this to 50 servers or 100 servers, all with the exact same settings, all from my console that happens to be in here.
That's awesome.
I hit install. It's a task in the background that's going to go off and run, give me an updates. I can get status updates from there in the back, and let me know that everything's going to be going off and going good.
That's awesome.
Now, the last thing I wanted to show you, obviously, as well, since you are a particular aficionado of PowerShell.
I happen to like it, yes.
I can go off and actually target this guy here and actually run Windows PowerShell, remoting directly into server number 7. And I can take a look at this particular guy. In this case, I wanted to say, get Windows features and just see what happens to come up on this box. Oops, if I can spell it right. Oop. There we go.
Tab.
I'm trying to do my tab. It's not coming up.
Huh?
Come on, get in there.
There it.
Oh, yeah. No, it didn't actually come in. You know what? Let's actually go off here and show this with an IIC perspective. I was having some issues. I'm new at PowerShell. It's a little bit nervous going on.
I'm going to show you how to do it.
Working within you. I want to go in. Let's actually go off and do an install of Windows features. I love how you can, the right-hand context-sensitive, just choose install Windows feature. And then I can also go in and view a GUI interface to be able to show me what the different parameters could be. But to stay away from the GUI, install Windows feature. There's tab complete now working here.
IntelliSense.
IntelliSense coming in. I can go in here and say computer name. IntelliSense is fixing that up for me. RD13-07 is the target. And I want to install the feature of Windows Server Backup. And then because I'm paranoid about this, do a what if. It's going to go and look. It's actually saying, I can't do it because I typed my server name wrong. I wish they had IntelliSense for server names. SRV.
Well, in fact, IntelliSense is extensible, so the community can write IntelliSense for server names. Yeah, you got to get the name of the feature right.
Look, there we go.
Excellent.
Remoting, it's all there.
That's awesome.
Thank you very much.
Okay, thanks, Rick.
I'll show you. Cheers.
Hey, cheers. So that's exciting stuff. And I will point out that Rick showed you being able to install server roles from the GUI or from the command line. Now, I mentioned to you that we had a deep investment in standards-based management. I encourage you to come to my talk. Aaron Chappell and I are giving a talk this afternoon on multi-machine capabilities, multi-machine management capabilities in Windows Server. And what I will show is installing a Windows Server role from a Linux machine using standards-based management. Crazy stuff. Okay, so again, here's the URL for drill-in sessions. Now, I want to talk to you about this notion of a hardware abstraction layer. All right, hardware abstraction layer. About 20-plus years ago, Microsoft worked with the community to produce what was known as the hardware abstraction layer. And the hardware abstraction layer is kind of the unsung hero of the x86 ecosystem. The hardware abstraction layer is the thing that gives you unprecedented choice and simplicity. None of us, I mean, how many of you go out there and say, hey, I was thinking about buying a PC, I wonder if Windows will run on it? You don't. It just does. And the reason it just does, the reason why old versions of Windows run on new hardware and new versions of Windows run on old hardware, is this notion of the hardware abstraction layer, a set of standards, protocols, and schemas that allow this great simplicity and choice. And so what we need to do as we move from an OS for a single machine to a cloud OS is we need the data center equivalent of the hardware abstraction layer. And that's what we're going to be building using standards-based management. And when I say standards, I mean SIM and WSMAN standards. And again, this is going to give you simplicity, choice, and make things just work. And so today, I'm very pleased to announce, for the first time ever, OMI. So you're familiar on Windows, we have WMI, the Windows Management Infrastructure. And we're announcing OMI, the Open Management Infrastructure. Jointly with the Open Group, Microsoft is releasing source code available today, which is an open source implementation of the standards SIM and WSMAN. And we have this up and running. It has API symmetry with WMI v2, and source code's available today at this. It is extremely small and extremely fast and can be ported to any device. Okay? So, with that, I've got a video. This is a technology demonstration showing, describing some of the problems and what we've done. So, please roll the video.
We worked with both Cisco and Arista to port OMI to their switches, and both companies are now implementing the DMTF standard schemas for networking. What I'll now show you is a technology demonstration of some of the things you'll be able to accomplish with a data center HAL. One of the most common sources of cloud service disruptions are misconfigured network settings. Every vendor has a different way to do this, and there are little to no automation. The problem is that sites like Azure configure the network hundreds of times a month. This demo shows how standards-based management can automate that process to reduce the risk of running an agile data center. Dozens of times a week, an Azure machine will have problems, and a repair sequence is initiated. If an automated repair does not succeed, the machine is shut down, its network port is disabled, and a technician is notified. It is super important to shut down the right network port. So here we've written a PowerShell script to automate the steps of that process using standards-based protocols and tools. This is now possible for the first time because the server's connected to an Arista switch running the new OMI management agent. Here I run the script with dash confirm so I can make sure it will do the right things. Here it is asking if I really want to shut down the computer, and it gives me the opportunity to suspend the script to check things out. Notice that this script has created sim sessions to the Arista switch, the base motherboard controller on the server, and to Windows running on that server, and that it is using the WSMAN protocol to talk to each of them. I'm going to first manage the base motherboard controller on the server. Here I'm talking to the raw hardware itself, not the OS. I'll be able to perform this operation even if the server was powered off. This is important. Notice that it's showing me the owner contact. The script retrieves this information and uses it to send email to the owner of the machine, telling them that it has been taken offline. Now I talk to the WMI agent on the OS to get some more information. This makes me confident that I'm shutting down the right machine. I'm going to hold off doing that until I'm sure everything else is perfect. The script is now about to disable the port on the network switch. I'm going to make sure that I'm shutting down the right port so I don't make front page news. Now, because this is an Arista switch that is running OMI, I'm able to use exactly the same standards-based protocols and tools that I use to manage the physical server and Windows to now manage my network switches. Here I get the information that makes me sure I'm disabling the right port. Once again, I'm going to defer this operation. Now that I'm sure everything is correct, I'm going to do the operation again using the minus verbose flag. Notice now that the script is showing me that it sent mail to the owner of the machine using the information it retrieved from the physical server. In this demo, you saw us use exactly the same standards, protocols, and tools to manage a physical server, a Windows operating system, and an Arista switch. Pretty impressive. But what's more impressive is that I mentioned that Cisco also has the OMI up and running in their networking switches. What that means is if I had another data center using Cisco switches, this script and all the drill-in diagnostics that I did would work exactly the same way in that environment without modification. That is what we mean by a hardware abstraction layer for the data center using standards-based management.
All right. Yeah, you like that? I got to tell you, we are just so excited by this approach. It is a new approach, very heavy on standards. Please, we have an entire session on standards support in Windows Server 2012. I encourage you to come to that. Okay, so now we're going to talk about delivering services to devices. We've got lots of devices, and we need to be able to deliver service to those in a secure, safe way. And so with that, I'm going to bring back Rick to talk about data security and compliance.
That's a long walk on that stage.
Welcome back. It is. Give it a hustle, man.
Here we go. From a client once again. Looking at one of the issues of having to go off and secure data. I'm sure you guys are all familiar with global groups inside local groups against protection for resources with access control lists. Well, we've added another layer of stuff to this if you want to. It doesn't replace it. It simply adds in an extra layer that you can now take advantage of with automation and with built-in processes, if you like. It's called dynamic access control. I'm just going to talk a little bit about first the different pieces that make up dynamic access control. We first of all have to go off and define resource properties that you can apply to individual resources like files, folders, and individual files. Mm-hmm. And then define what can be classified in that environment. I can classify a department with a file. I can classify a level of impact. As an example, for impact, I can make it into an ordered list that my automation software, my user, or background processes can go off and identify as being a low or moderate or a high and give it a value. It can do calculations against these values to determine, oh, that needs to be protected. Let's go off and encrypt that with rights management systems and that sort of stuff. That applies to individual objects. Now, we also have claim types, and claim types are something that apply to Active Directory objects. So, for instance, remember those department fields inside the Active Directory mm-hmm. that no one ever really filled out? Now you can, and we can actually include those as ACLs. And so as someone moves between different processes within HR, they will actually go in and have these new permissions applied to them. In this case, we've got a department identified that's simply pointing to the department string within Active Directory as far as an attribute's concerned. We also have a country defined there as well. Now, where this comes into play is when you combine these different pieces of both resource properties and claim individual claims down into individual rules. And then these rules are collected together into policies that are then going off and applied. These rules are centrally applied, and you can define a very simple rule like this one that says finance department, that says whenever the resource that says finance department equals finance, go ahead and grant the following rights, full control. Mm-hmm. Pretty simple sort of stuff.
Makes sense.
To actually see this in application, I'm going to minimize this out of the way and bring up that file share. I've got a file share over here on my data server.
Yeah.
And you can take a look here and see that if I choose properties of that folder, it now has, because it received the group policy, it got the centralized rules applied to it, I can now have this classification thing, and the department is auto-configured for this particular file share, but not impact and personally identifiable information. We'll leave that till some other time. But what I do have is the traditional security tab where I'm used to seeing my share permissions and my group permissions to be able to give the ACL to individual people. If I click on advanced, I now have this view that includes a central policy view that says that there's a central policy that's been applied. It's called the finance department rule, where resource department equals finance, grant them full rights.
Yeah.
Very, very simple down at the bottom. We also have the condition that says if it's finance intern, grant them read and execute. Very simple sort of stuff. Now, to prove to you that it works, if I go back to Active Directory just to quickly show you my users, I've got a user here named Ben. Ben Smith happens to work in the finance department, as you can see down below, so yeah. He's good. And I also have Ashley as well. Ashley does not work in finance department. She's just a new hire that hasn't been classified yet, so she doesn't have access according to the way the rules work. To put that into practice, go back in here to my finance properties, and I can say, let's do a effective permissions and see what Ben gets. Ben gets evaluated for effective access, and we now see that due to the rule, he gets full control.
Yeah.
If I go back and I say, you know what, let's not check Ben, let's go off and check Ashley. View effective access, she now gets blocked. Now, as Ashley gets promoted to become a financial intern, she could then potentially have read-only access to this particular share. And as she leaves finance and decides to do an internship over in marketing, she removes access automatically.
So this is what if for ACLs.
You got it.
That's awesome.
So it's another layer on top of shares, on top of groups, and then now claims-based authentication for resource access and for individual user classification.
Wow. That rocks.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Have a good day.
Okay. And again, last chance to get this URL, so if you haven't gotten it, get it now. Okay, so Windows Server 2012. It's a cloud-optimized operating system. You know, when they asked me to do this talk, I was reminded of a Woody Allen joke, right? Woody Allen once said he took a speed reading course, and last night he read War and Peace in 20 minutes. He said, it's about Russia. And so as we look at all the features that we had to discuss, and we said, hey, talk about that in an hour, it's literally impossible to do. So what we tried to do was to focus in on some of the highlights and to then encourage you to the breakout sessions. There is a ton of amazing stuff here. Windows Server 2012 is an engineering tour de force. And we have brought, again, some of the people who worked on the code, some of the world's best engineers, here to talk to you, to present them to you, and it's your opportunity to meet these people. I mean, these are industry legends. These are the people you're going to be talking about for a long time, and they're here this week to talk to you. So go out of your way and meet these guys. They did a great job. And the press on this stuff has been absolutely fabulous, right? Computer World said that Windows Server 2012 takes your breath away. Jason Perel of ZDNet said, nothing from Microsoft, and I mean literally nothing, has ever been this ambitious. And of course, Al Gillian of IDC said, 2012 will be VMware's last year as King of the Hill. This is a very exciting release. we've talked to you, we found out what your pain points were, we found out what challenges you had, and we responded to it. So please pick up Windows Server 2012, deploy it, I think you're gonna love it, and fill out those evaluations. We really do listen to those evaluations, and thank you so much for your time. This has been great.